I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Tim Hernandez.
Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
Today we'll be interviewing our special guest, Andrea Cote Botero, whose new book, La Ruina Que Nombro, is out. So you want to be sure to check that out. But we're going to have a wonderful interview with her. So,
and Andrea is actually in the studio with us right now. She is a professor here at the University of Texas, El Paso, in the Department of Creative Writing, which is a bilingual department. And actually, Tim and Andrea started the exact same year, which was a while back. You guys are still
2 years now,
new faculty members.
We will keep being.
Yeah, the new faculty smell is worn off already. Yeah. So.
No, yet.
But, you know, the new car smell. Yeah. Come on, you guys get that.
And so we're just going to talk about your poetry, your background, and anything that comes up. But first, let me give a little background of who you are. You are from Colombia.
I am.
You are the author of at least two books of poems, Puerto Calcinado and Cosas Frágiles, as well as a study of the Peruvian poet Blanca Varela.
Mm-hmm.
And your poems have been translated into many languages. I think one of the numbers I've encountered is 7 different languages, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
So I imagine English would be one of those. What are the other 6 languages?
Like Italian, I saw, you know, there's...
Italian, I do have a translation. French. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me here. Allow me to also say hello to all the people that is listening. Words on a Wire, a great, very great archive of contemporary poetry. It's great what you guys do here. And I'm very happy to be part of this community and also very happy of being here today. Yeah. So yes, and like coming back to this, I was very lucky with my first published poetry book. Something happened to me. I got the national prize for young poets with this book.
In Colombia.
And at that time, there was a partnership between the university that established that prize and a magazine. It's a literary magazine. The name is El Mal Pensante, and it's very well distributed through the country. So they had this partnership. Well, the national prizes and some future poets will be distributed with the magazine. So I got 12,000 copies of my first book. And some of the poets that I knew that were like my mentors, they told me like, we don't know what to tell you because you have already so much to be ashamed of. like the summary of like, you know, the first book is the one that probably always is going to be inadvertent at the end.
Right.
But I didn't have the chance. And it was really good because the book was sent out to places which were now major cities. And I was very happy for that because it gave me back like answers from unexpected readers.
Yes.
And I, when I was growing up, I was one of those people who lived in a city which was very distant from the happening scene. And I depended on those publications. And nowadays with the internet, everything is different.
Sure.
Nobody is that isolated. But I was. So the newspaper and the magazines were very important to me. So I was very happy to replicate that. So after that, the book, it received some attention.
Sure.
And part of that attention was represented in publications. The first one was to Italian as a book lent. The other publications, I mean, the whole book has been already published in Italian and in French as it is, as a whole book. The other translations are from selected poems from this book and the second one.
You're talking about Puerto Calcinado, right?
Yeah.
I have a copy of the French translation in my hand. It's Port Brûlé. And it is a bilingual edition. It's both in English and Spanish. I love this book.
Thank you so much.
I bought it at a poetry reading one time. You probably didn't notice me, you know, because I was just another fan. but I bought this book, and I love it. And the translation, you know, I suppose is good. I don't know. My French and my Spanish are equally as bad. But I'm able to. I love reading this. I love reading it in French. I love reading it in Spanish. I remember one time I got a story translated into Italian. It was in some sort of anthology, and I thought, this is going to be awesome. I'm going to read it with an Italian accent. And I looked at it, but then after like a couple of sentences, I go, never mind. And I just gave up. What's it like to see your poems in a language that maybe you don't know that well? I assume you know a little bit of French, a little bit of Italian, but has there been a language that you just
I got some points translated to Macedonian when I was there.
Macedonian? Yeah, I don't even know what that language is. My God.
Well, it's actually very, very interesting. It's all Cyrillic, and I couldn't believe all of those and backwards were my actual writing.
Wow, yeah.
But it, yeah, I was there in 2005 because this book also won the Poetry Prize for the first book for young poet by UNESCO and the International Poetry Festival of Macedonia.
It was like the best debut book worldwide. You know, that's
it was very good. Yeah,
which the United Nations, you know, that they administer that.
But it was like, imagine, like, I couldn't get a sense of what they were like getting from whatever they were reading. Right. No, I mean, with the Romance languages and with the English, that it's now it's a closed language to me. The experience is completely different, and you as a writer know that very well, that you discover things because you're still able to read your own book, but is that word like somebody else's book. Mm-hmm. And then you start to discover things about the other possibilities in your books. No, this, the whole thing about the art of translations. For example, I do believe seriously that the Italian translation of Puerto Calcinado is much, it's really superior to the real book. When I read it, I say, oh my God, it is so musical. It is so perfect. She did a great job. Wow. And the translator, she even got a prize for that. And I was very happy because it really sounds like, I don't know, maybe she cared more about little details and organizing things. Right. That's the thing with the translation. And now that I am in our bilingual program, all the time I'm facing the experience of words moving from one language to the other. In our poetry workshop, for example, our students are pretty generous and they translate themselves all the time, and they translate their classmates all the time. And then when they give back like the translations to the original writer, they discover new things about their own poetry. And they say, wow, all this potential was here.
How old were you when you learned English? I mean, the way you are now, obviously you teach graduate seminars in English. And so,
I try.
You know, you got a PhD from the University of Pennsylvania.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But when did you start reading and writing and communicating in English?
It's all very recent, actually. When I had the small amount of English classes when I was growing up in my hometown, Barranca Bermeja, I went to a nun school. And so their definition...
A non-school?
Non-school.
None?
Yeah.
Wow.
Spanish.
Nun?
Spanish. Yeah.
Wow. Catholic
those
school.
Girls, yeah. Catholic school, but nuns and everything. And their definition of English class was pretty much translating songs and things like that.
Wow.
So I didn't know. But I knew when I was growing up that I wanted to see the world and I wanted to go outside. And language was the key for that.
Yeah.
So I start to try to learn little by little on myself. And it was pretty hard. However, well, I reached a time for being able to get on a scholarship at the United States. To be fully bilingual wasn't necessary anymore.
Right.
I did my first master at Stony Brook University at Long Island.
Right.
And my English was very limited. I was very good reading. And because that was what I was able to manage. But all the speaking, that it came later. And just there was one day while I was in New York around 2007 when I was getting distracted by the sound of the speakers on an airport. And I said, oh, that's it. It's in my head already. Because I was never distracted English before that day.
Wow.
Shifted the shift.
What a wonderful moment. Have you written about that moment?
No, ever. No.
That'd be a great poem.
So the title of your first book is Puerto Calcinado, which is Port in Ashes.
Yeah.
It's a translation. And, you know, you mentioned the town that you were raised at, Barranca Bermeja.
Yes.
In Colombia. Tell us a little bit about your upbringing there and what about, you know, coming from a rural place like that, which is actually, as I understand, it's like an oil port.
Town. It is an oil port. Yeah.
So tell us about what your upbringing sort of, you know, how does that living in that rural situation start to influence a young poet in the making?
Well, like what built me as a poet was, in my opinion, well, now that I look backwards, it's the particular landscape we mm-hmm. have there, and the fact that it was a very violent place. And mm-hmm. you know, Colombia is a place we have faced a terrible war for the last 50 years, but the 90s were a particularly difficult time. Like at the end of the 90s, in my hometown, there was an ongoing war inside of the city, between what you would call the armies mm-hmm. nowadays, that is the guerrillas on the one side and the paramilitaries on the yes. other side. And while I was growing up there, you had people shoot dead every day mm-hmm. from one side or the other. And the other, well, that's one condition that we right. have there. But I was very little. I wasn't really like in touch with the actual violence in the sure. sense that I heard, you know, that right. this person died, the other person died of no natural causes.
Right.
And one day I had one experience that changed everything. I was 16 years old and I was walking back from school to my house and I saw what is the biggest street, like what you consider like the central street in my right. my town, and it was closed, and there were some coffins, empty coffins, displayed on the whole thing. There were 36 wow. coffins. They were all painted white, and they had pictures of the people inside. And it was a massacre wow. perpetrated by paramilitaries, and they took 36 people from their houses. 1 week before that day, and they disappeared then, and the family was never recovered anything from them.
Wow.
And then they sent a notice saying that they were judged by a military, well, paramilitary court, and they were and they received their punishment. Mm. So then I start writing. This is this story. It's that image is included on my book.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the poem House of Stone is the end of the poem. But the book that I started writing when I was 16, it was all about feeling fear outside the house and inside the house, like all that violence, like just coming into the house. So it pictures the voices of two little girls right. that are talking about how they were, but not it was never my idea to talk about violence. I just wanted to talk about life inside of a house. Mm. Like, but violence is inside there. So it's just one way to look at that experience. The other thing that happens there is a very warm town, very warm. Uh-huh. It's 40 Celsius degrees, 365 days a year.
90 degrees.
I think more than 90, right, 95, right. Yeah. something
80.
Like that.
Yeah, about 100, yeah.
It's like fever the whole year. Yeah. And 97% wow. of humidity.
Wow.
So it's just very difficult to be outside.
Right. I'm sure,
people
yeah.
is never outside. And so the yeah. whole time looks ghostly,
yeah.
plus the violence and the particular. The name of the town is Barranca Bermeja, which means Red Cliff. And that's what was a name that wow. Spanish gave it to the town when they saw it for the first time,
mm-hmm.
because all the land was very dry and was very red. So I just kind of combined the relationship between the landscape and the social situation
right.
and the voice of the book, that is the two girls talking about this.
Mm.
And I did the book. But I was very young when I did it. My idea was not to talk about violence at all. But that was the reasons I believe that was the reason why this book was so important for certain people at certain
right.
point, because it was able to talk about our violence, but in different terms.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think that probably is a more organic and fresh way to approach any kind of issue, rather than say, I want to write about violence because it affects me.
Absolutely.
You know, you write about an image, you write about a house, you mm-hmm. write about voices, and the violence, because it's part of the landscape, comes out.
Yeah,
of it.
And also what happened is, like, we have so much violence in Colombia that we have been overexposed to the language of violence.
Oh,
like,
wow, yeah.
until the point, I mean, and that happened with images as
right.
well. Like,
yeah,
we are kind of being anesthetized. Through that.
Right.
So that's one of the, in my opinion, that's one of the functions of poetry, you know, to kind of refresh the language to talk about things.
Hmm.
Because, like we have so much violence in Colombia, like, people don't even pay attention anymore.
Wow.
Because we have a 50 years war going on.
We're talking to Andrea Cote Botero. You came from Colombia, went to New York, and then you went to Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And then you come to El Paso, Ciudad Juarez, which is kind of interesting in the sense that we had Juarez was one of the most violent cities in the world a couple of years
like
before you
places.
Arrived.
Yeah, obviously.
So how did it feel coming to a place that has such a reputation of violence and murder and death?
It's funny because the first time I was invited to Juarez was in 2010 when they invited me to a poetry reading.
Oh, that was at the height of the violence, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and my mother told me, you can't go there. Are you crazy? Like, and you can't. And I said, Mom, I'm from Colombia. I'm never afraid of violence.
It's like when Juarez is like, I'm not going to Colombia.
Yeah, people like, when I used to live in Philadelphia, also some people were so scared because Philadelphia has those high rates of crime. And violence. And I said, like, it's a walk in the park. At that time, I couldn't come for different reasons to the International Poetry Festival of Juarez. But I knew about the city and the troubles. And of course, as Colombians, we always pay attention to all that happens in Mexico because it's a parallel history somehow, you know, because of the violence that derives from narco traffic and drug dealers.
Sure.
But the thing is, when I first heard about the job that they had at El Paso, I was so interested, especially because I knew writers that were here before. And that was my first notice from this program. I knew people in Colombia and Mexico, writers as Yuri Herrera, Miguel Ildefonso, that is a great Peruvian poet. They all were students in this program. And then I said, wow. But I didn't know anything about El Paso. The only thing that I knew about El Paso was that it was next to Ciudad Juarez. And and then you make the relationship. You say, like, it should be like that. No? But it's completely different.
Oh, yeah.
It's
yeah.
like two different universes that look at each other in the face all
every
the
day.
Time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the other thing I knew about El Paso was that a character in Breaking Bad had a neighbor's breakdown when he was sent here for a week.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that. He was the DEA agent.
But then I came to meet the place and the interview and everything, and I just felt something that I keep feeling, that is a way where everyone can think. I think the presence of the desert is so overwhelming, even though we have houses and cars and everything. I still feel like I live in the desert.
Yeah.
And that makes me just feel like we go back to that tradition of, it's a Christian tradition, of people who goes to the desert because they need to hear their voice, their own voice, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I feel here. And like I feel like the desert is like forcing me to talk to myself, like for real, like not all that noise. And on the other hand, like the richness of being so close to Mexico, that I, like, my favorite thing about it is that you can cross the border and get Cuban rum and books in Spanish.
Cuban rum and books.
Yeah. In Spanish, no?
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Because they have this
Club Havana, right?
Club Havana, yeah. I'm married to a Cuban, so.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
We should do that.
So when you and I read, we had the opportunity to read together last year. Gosh, was it about a year ago or something? Maybe 2 years ago? I don't know. Anyway, you had this, you know, you pulled out this really brilliant, after you read your poetry, you pulled out this really brilliant, it looked like a giant-sized Chinese takeout box. And then you unfolded it, and it was like a poem. There were like poems, and, you know, going on inside of that and outside of it. You know, you talked right now about as poets, we have to sort of refresh the language, you know. But obviously, you know, you've kind of taken that to another level, to another step. You know, is that kind of the direction that you've been going lately? Is creating these?
Yeah,
like,
that's
you know,
the direction I've been going lately. I wrote a book after Puerto Calcinado, after Pouring Ashes, but I feel that book that is the one that recently came out in Visor, in Madrid. That is a book that a little bit takes the same tone from Puerto Calcinado.
Mm.
So in this new project, that late project, what I'm trying to do is to find a new voice, steal my own voice, but just to kind of recreate what I do.
Right.
So it took me a lot of effort to not being attached to my to the tone of my first book, because it's a big temptation,
right, no, for sure,
to
for
go
sure,
back
yeah.
there.
Yeah. It is,
so
yeah.
And then I found in 2008, I was trying to look for experiences that will help me to refresh my own voice. But I realized that it was not just about what I was reading. It was also about the process of writing itself, mm-hmm. that I needed to look for something that will, like, really rock me somehow.
Right, right.
No?
Yeah, yeah.
Because everything mm-hmm. was, like, still that voice of the girl in my hometown,
right.
the person that I was not
yes.
anymore. So I went to work with some bookmaking in Argentina. Mm-hmm. I got a scholarship from the University of Pennsylvania because they have money for that. And
yeah.
and then I went there and I was working with the bookmaking, and I realized that one way to look at the page differently is to actually look at it differently. It's not anything
great.
New.
Yes.
It's something that Mallarmé
sure.
did on the 19th century, but
right.
I kind of needed a reminder of that. So I start like doing my own book with my own hands, like looking for ways to find a shape for these new poems I was writing. And then I realized I was writing a lot about Chinese. Not Chinese, but
yeah.
about Chinatown. Because
oh, yeah,
it's not really about any, I don't know
Chinatown
anything about
in
China.
Buenos Aires or
no, in New York.
In New York.
Like,
yeah.
By the time I was doing that, I was like just kind of trying to recollect my experiences in New York. And in every Chinatown in general, you know, these poems, they talk a lot about the appearances of things and how we live in a world of appearances in which we trade plastic mm-hmm. things. It's pretty much about plastic. It was pretty disappointing for me when I finally get to Paris one day and Florence. I did my trip to Europe.
Right.
And everything I was trying to buy was made in China.
and
it was like
yeah.
a little bit, and it was expensive. And it gave me like a, it was a sad side of tourism, like mm-hmm. like the fact that you believe you are living this experience, but in reality you are not really living it.
Right.
It's
yeah.
pre-made.
Right.
It's plastic.
Right, right.
So I was trying to find myself writing a little bit more ironically about experiences
right, right. Mm-hmm.
around. And then I found this a person that helped me to came out with this. He was an artist. It's a Colombian artist, a friend of mine, who helped me. I was very worried about having like a good platform for these poems about Chinatown. So he helped me to construct this shiny box where every poem is a noodle made of paper.
Yeah.
You
know? Right, yeah.
So what I do is I made it in my computer. I printed it. Kinkos, and my friends and family, they helped me to put the guillotine on that, and it's pretty. It's
right.
not good as a business, of course. It's,
sure,
it's
yeah.
just an example of, and for me, it's a ritual object because since this is a book, it's a work in process. What I do is like every time I have a reading, I put different noodles on it, and I take out the noodles I don't like anymore. Until the day I feel the book is complete.
Wow,
no?
That's
so it's like a ritual object for
I
me.
I love that
you know?
Idea, the ritual object, you know, that's and then how you're constantly, you know, feeding it and it's feeding you, you know, and so it's all process. It's all part of the writer's process.
Yeah, yeah. There are some Chinese stores at downtown El Paso that I have found and I'm trying to incorporate.
Nice.
Yeah, there is one called Casa Asia where you can find like the most spectacular scenes for $1.
I love those stores.
would you be willing to read a poem
for
us?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yes, please. Yeah. If you're just joining us, we are speaking with the poet and professor Andrea Cote Botero, who will be sharing some poems with us shortly.
I'm going to read one poem from Pouring Ashes, since we have talked about it a lot. And going to read the poem Puerto Quebrado. The name is Broken Port. Si supieras que afuera de la casa, atado a la orilla del puerto quebrado, hay un río quemante como las aceras, que cuando toca la tierra es como un desierto al derrumbarse y trae hierba encendida para que ascienda por las paredes, aunque te des a creer que el muro perturbado por las enredaderas es milagro de la humedad y no de la ceniza del agua. Si supieras que el río no es de agua y no trae barcos ni maderos, solo pequeñas algas crecidas en el pecho de hombres dormidos. Si supieras que ese río corre y que es como nosotros o como todo lo que tarde o temprano tiene que hundirse en la tierra. Tú no sabes, pero yo alguna vez lo he visto. Hace parte de las cosas que cuando se están yendo parece que se quedan.
We could play that poem on a loop and just listen to it over and over and
go
over.
Go to sleep.
And even if we don't understand. You know, I remember when I grew up, I grew up around Spanish speakers who didn't teach us Spanish for various cultural and personal reasons. But I remember hearing the adults speaking Spanish as I was falling asleep, and it always became a very soothing language for me. As I started to learn it myself, mm-hmm. Spanish, you were talking about that moment in the airport where you realized you were distracted by the English over the loudspeaker, which had never distracted you before. And at that point, you knew you had entered into English as an English speaker. And I remember having a similar experience where I was at in Mexico City at the, I think, the Anthropological Museum. I forget exactly where. And I was reading about the exhibit. And then I went to the next one. And I realized I didn't know if I had read the English version or the Spanish version. I just completely forgot.
Yeah.
And that was like, oh, that's kind of cool.
Great. That's great, yeah.
And now that you are completely articulate in both languages, and I, like I said, you probably dabble in other languages, do you ever want to write in English or translate your own poems or work with the translator actively? Or are you still just going to give your poems over to a translator?
Oh, the last one I definitely would like to do, and I have done it with a couple of people who have made translations, even though I believe that the translator is not a secondary author or something like that. Like, the translations are the property, are the creation of the translator. Mm-hmm. So I try to be very respectful through decisions. Like, I mean, if people decided they want to do it a certain way, I believe that if you give permission to a person to do the translations, they're going to do something that reflect them as well as they reflect. I mean, they come from your work. But anyway, sometimes I really love to have those conversations of saying like, oh, well, you did this or what you did that. And especially because Spanish language is so – it's in itself like a bunch of languages, no? Because we have so many dialects.
Right.
And I have like a collection of funny stories with like colloquial things. For example, I have a poem in which I wrote – I go in your walk. The word was marcha, but this person learned Spanish in Spain, and in Spain, irse de marcha is like to go for drinks the whole night, one bar, like bar hopping.
Right, he translated
that, and when I read that, I said, "What is this?" And so that kind of thing, I feel it's very interesting. Like, that's the easiest one, like of the three options you gave. because that definitely you do, no? Because you review the translations.
Right.
And the second thing is I'm starting to translate myself, and I want to, I mean, not translate my own poems, but to translate poems from English to Spanish. And I want to continue in that path because it definitely enhances my connection as a reader with particular writers. And it really gives me a new dimension on Spanish, on English language.
Right.
And in Spanish as well. Even though I realize now that I'm starting to translate scattered poems from authors I like, how difficult is the work of a translator? My brain hurts every time I try to do it. So I don't understand. People never get paid enough for doing that kind of thing.
Right,
and most
of
the time they do it ad honorem.
That's right.
But this is an incredibly good exercise. And I intend to continue translating, especially poetry and contemporary poetry, because that I also feel that that's our duty.
Right.
To promote in other places.
Sure.
Some great poets are not even known in the Spanish-speaking world because they don't have translations. That's why they cannot do presentations and things like that.
Well, the students here definitely at the University of Texas here in El Paso are very, very lucky to have you. And, of course, we're lucky to have you here. And we are speaking with the poet and professor, Andrea Cote Botero, about her wonderful new book of poetry, La Ruina Que Nombro. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Tim Hernandez.
And we'll see you next week.